Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me today is Steve Chu and Christine Peek, and we're going to get into the broken pieces of Star Trek Picard, Episode 8. Steve, Christine, how are you both doing today?
Good. You know, it's an interesting time in our nation's history and a great time to talk about Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely excited to join you guys. I feel like I've been missing out listening to your podcast.
Yeah, welcome, Christine. Yay.
Yeah, just because you were busy with work and motion practice and depots and all that stuff. So,
Yeah.
Who knew that happened with lawyers, that sometimes we have work to do.
Well, what could be more important than Star Trek, really? You know.
Fair point. Well, let's get into this. So, we start out with a flashback of pre-attack on Mars, and it's the Jad Vash on the Grief planet. And we've met a bunch of these women before, and a bunch who are just now cannon fodder, that they have this mind link, and they get this preview of what happened. Was it 250,000 years ago when AI advanced on whatever world the Romulans were on after leaving Vulcan? Or maybe they were still Vulcans at that point in time. I don't know. That's point of discussion. And all hell breaks loose. They all get vivid flashbacks and shots of information that's difficult to process. A couple just outright pull out a disruptor and blow their brains out. Others claw off their faces. It does not go well. The only two that come out completely unscathed are Commodore O, who we learn is half Romulan, and the creepy sister who likes to touch her brother. They make it out in one piece, and turns out Auntie, the one who was assimilated and shut down the Borg cube, she's having a rough day. So she didn't claw out her eyes, but she does have a little breakdown. Let's discuss. So this is O's motivation to blow the hell out of Mars and tank the Romulan relief effort. You know, if we apply the necessity defense, was the terrorist attack on Mars in any way justifiable? And, you know, Christine, your thoughts on that?
Necessity. that's interesting. I wonder if we can actually back up a little bit, because I'm kind of curious to get your guys' thoughts on what they actually see, because we just get a few glimpses of what's happening. And presumably it's some type of, you know, singularity type event that causes extinction. This is kind of sounding familiar in the Star Trek context. I was wondering what you guys thought about what these women see and how profoundly it affects them, and maybe that's just a good starting point for our analysis of necessity. Is this an emergency that justifies doing something drastic?
Steve, why don't you go first with your thoughts on this?
So that's a good point. You know, let's try to get the facts straight before we jump into analysis, right? like any good attorney. But so I completely geeked out over this episode. I will preface it by saying that I think I've seen it about 7 times now, and I've tried freeze framing a lot of it because I had the same questions Christine had. In the beginning, we are hit with just a lot of bombarded, probably is the better word, with a lot of powerful images, some very disturbing. You know, we see a world blowing up. We see faces that people believe are, one is, I think, very clearly Data. Then another one I didn't quite recognize, but other people claim that it's Lal, you know, the daughter that he makes in Next Generation, and then later passes away. We also get some very odd images. There's one of what looks like a fox or a dog that appears to be dead, and then his insides or remains start moving as if there's some sort of nanotechnology. Very, very odd. I think we are meant to believe that these images are the results of what would happen if the machines or if this AI essentially takes over the universe. You know, it's definitely a cautionary tale. And it comes in the form of what they call the admonition, where, you know, all we're told, and we kind of piece this together, some ancient race, and we don't know who, was able to pull these eight planets together, sort of as this signal to the whole universe, like, hey, come here and take a look. And then on one of these planets, presumably the world of grief, as they call it, there is this contraption that if you walk in and you touch it, you are now flooded with these memories, which appear to be serving as a warning beacon, you know, against creating AI. Just be careful of what might happen, because look at what happened to us. You know, the other part I would add to that is it's very interesting also that this group is only women, and I counted 10 because I thought this might be the Conclave of Eight, but then we later find out the Conclave of Eight seems to be a reference to the eight planets, so a place rather than, you know, a group of people. But they are all women, and I wonder if that's going to have some significance, because I think O even says, instead of like brothers and sisters, she just says sort of like sisters. You know, for ages we've been sort of the guardians of this. So I don't know, but nothing's really on accident here, but that may play out more in the future. So I think that's really what we get, is just a series of nonstop, you know, disturbing images, a lot of AI data, law, worlds being destroyed, animals dying. And then it also begs the question, okay, if this all happened in the past, how did they stop it, or did they stop it? You know?
Yeah, it's later discussed more like a first contact type event, but jumping to the law, you know, we get into the issue of what is the necessity of defense. And that's a situation where a criminal act is done in order to stop something worse from happening. And, you know, the test generally includes that there is a specific threat or significant imminent danger. There was a immediate necessity to act. There was no practical alternative to the act. The defendant didn't cause or contribute to the threat. He or she out of necessity at all times. Defendant acted out of necessity at all times, and the harm caused wasn't greater than the harm prevented. And there's a big caveat for that, and that's this doesn't apply to killing people. So, you know, you can't kill an innocent person at all. So that's the catch-all that really kind of torpedoes the necessity defense, you know, which is, again, you can't do that. But let's get into, and same thing can happen with duress. You can't kill someone under duress. But what's this all mean from what they saw, that they think there's an extinction level event that will take place if AI is allowed to continue? And what sparks that is images of data, and then what's happening on Mars with the synthetics that are kind of on the simpleton side. They're being used to augment labor. Well, I mean, like, I got mixed feelings on this for a variety of reasons. One, that sensory overload, it's tough to come up with a rational plan if people's reaction to it is either, you know, throwing up or blowing their brains out. It's tough to come up with a rational plan if that's the reaction of somebody claws off their face or disruptor to the temple. So it's tough to completely understand what happened. It's interesting to see that the showrunners have this AI bug after Discovery last season, which was not clear on AI bad until, well, it's just very mixed message of why is AI bad. And they're repeating that with Picard, and they're now outright saying why AI is bad, because data was fundamentally good. Now, if the test was lore, well, okay, that's a different situation, but then it still turns into profiling that, you know, that only white people are in the Klan, therefore all white people are dangerous because they can be white nationalists. Like, that's not a sane reaction to a situation of they're all inherently dangerous.
Do you think that's where they're going with this, Josh? Because you, on the flip side, you do have Picard and his great affection for Data. It seems like on that side, the show's expressing through that character maybe a little bit more skepticism of this genuinely held, it seems, belief by these women in the Jatvash that this is an inevitability that they absolutely have to do everything to prevent. Where do you think they're going with this? You have these two sides that are in conflict.
Yeah, a lot of places is my reaction to that. There's, you know, the entire premise of Starfleet is, and thus, you know, Star Trek for what we've been watching for over 50 years, is to seek out new life and new civilizations. Well, if there's an AI race, that's new life and new civilizations. You know, I mean, you think they would have learned a little from V'ger. And again, this is a theme that they've been playing with going back to the ultimate computer in Nomad, with AI, you know, in those situations being dangerous, to V'ger being, you know, what's its evolution? And continuing with that, where are they going with this?
It's maybe an unfair question.
Yeah.
Right now we see Picard, and of course he believes that he wants to rescue Soji, and he's so fervent in his belief, you know, equally, and on the opposite side it seems like. I thought that was interesting because it did seem in Discovery comparatively it was just sort of accepted on faith that control has to be stopped and they have to do everything to stop him. But this one, it seems a little bit more muddy. You're not really sure exactly what Soji's ultimate end game is, or if she has one, or if she's going to be somehow able to exercise some agency over what her choices in the future are, regardless of whatever Maddox may have intended her to do on that cube.
Yeah, it's a little early to tell because the story's still going on, but I do, you know, believe in the ultimate premise of Star Trek is that different doesn't mean dangerous, and
infinite diversity, infinite combinations, right?
Yeah, so I mean that would seem to be a massive backstep from the entire value system that the show has put forth that. Like humanity could get along, and you know, stories written in the 1960s where people, you know, there were race riots, there was serious unpleasantness. You know, we had the Civil Rights Act, we had the Voting Rights Act, you know, all after the Freedom Riders and assassination of civil rights leaders, and if not just, you know, those boots on the ground who are being terrorized, like that's the backstory of these stories that come out. And while it does evolve with the times of like, how do we make, you know, the Soviet Union not the bad guy anymore,
right,
after Glasnost and Perestroika, you know, it's, and we're at that time now of like AI displacing jobs and, you know, what will self-driving cars do? I mean, like there's all kinds of questions you know, that people think, well, if we just ban ride-sharing apps in our city, all the tech people will leave once and for all, and then it can go back to the 1950s and it'd be a nice artist utopia where no one can work. It's like, yeah, San Francisco would never be that again. And it also presumes that it once was. You need people working and making money so you can have things like social services. But where are they going to go with this? I don't think it's supposed to be the annihilation of all life. And, you know, the Romulan reaction is, you know, kind of the Soviet reaction of, hey, we'll just cover up Chernobyl. Like, if we say it's not a problem, if we don't allow testing, then we'll keep the numbers down and everything will be fine because people won't think there's a pandemic. You know, stuff like that. And so again, the truth is the crucible, and you know, like this is what we want. So I think we'll probably get a better idea of it. But right now, I'm fine with these people are all mass murderers and should be taken out in the street and shot. But I'm a little old fashioned.
You know, I think there are some really interesting points raised just in the first couple minutes, the first scene of this episode. You know, the best villains, if you will, are always the ones who are complex and actually believe in what they're doing. You know, history has shown us that people who are judged history's villains, they never think of themselves as the villains. They always think that they're right, everyone else is wrong. They think that they're justified. So what we have here is a group of people who see themselves as sort of like the defenders of the universe. You know, they alone have knowledge of what may come and what has come before when AI gets out of control. So they are the protectors of the universe, and they need to do whatever it takes to stop the growth of AI so that we don't repeat the mistakes of history. I mean, it's a very interesting way to look at it. Even if you disagree with them, you know, you can at least see or understand why they think the way they do. And I think this says a lot about just who the races are culturally too, because Romulan society is based upon secrecy and sort of in imposing fear. So they automatically think, all right, well, we need to just wipe out all AI. However, when Picard learns of this, and you know, granted, he hasn't seen the images yet, but he's been told at least what will ultimately happen. He approaches it from a very different perspective of more like compassion, caring, that these are people, they have rights. We go right back to Measure of a Man. You know, our mission is to search for new life. Well, there it sits. This is new life. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to become evil and destroy us. And Picard says that's a reaction from fear, and that's why Starfleet failed when we shut down all research on AI following the attack on Mars. You know, we shouldn't let fear dictate, you know, where we go. There have been some good discussions too. A lot of parallels can be drawn with other sci-fi genres. One of the most direct would be the reimagined Battlestar Galactica, you know, where we create AI in the form of Cylons and then they rise up and destroy us. And that entire series, in the series finale, ends with them sort of rebooting humanity on another planet, jumping way to the future, and you seeing that humanity is now reaching a point where they might start to invent AI again. And the Cylons are just kind of talking amongst themselves, well, is it going to happen again? You know, are the Cylons going to rise up and kill everyone, or are they going to sidestep it? And we don't know. You know, they leave the question open. So I think it's, and you know, you get into the Terminator 2 references too with Skynet, like no fate but what we make. Yeah, I think Picard's message is good, you know, which is, you know, we don't know that it's going to be this way. There's not necessarily a predeterminism that we should still proceed from courage and compassion. You know, I think that was a classic Picard moment there.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. And Christine, your thoughts on that?
well, as Steve was talking, I was just thinking through the murders that Commodore O has in some way inspired because of this belief that she has. So she's, as we start to learn in this episode, the reason why Rios seems to suffer from a type of post-traumatic stress disorder is that he has these memories of Vandermeer committing this act, which was inspired ultimately by O. She's ordered these killings through direct order, and then of course in the previous episodes we learned that that she's likely responsible for the death of Maddox by coercing Agnes through the mind meld, and then again apparently she's also tried to coerce Agnes to kill Soji. It doesn't quite succeed in that, at least not yet. And so is there any way that O has any kind of defense? Or Josh, are you just ready to string her up?
Yeah, I'm kind of more on this. I've seen enough evidence to, you know, throw her in the stockade or firing a squad. I'm fine with that.
And well, that was easy.
Yeah. Here's why. It's she ordered a captain to execute two people, you know, in a summary fashion on the spot because of what they were, not of what they did, because of what they were. Mm-hmm. That's an illegal order. He should not have followed it. And the fact that O said, and if you don't follow my illegal order, I will have your ship blown up. Again, totally not Starfleet. She's bad. So yeah, that's enough, you know, for going after her. You throw in Mars, you know, there's no defense to this. This is like defending a war crime that, like, well, we were just trying to make Germany great again. It's like, yeah, go to hell. Enjoy this prison cell or you're going to go get hung. So yeah, it's no sympathy for her.
You know, Josh,
go ahead. Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, you raise an interesting point there, Josh, because O gives that execution order to Captain Vandermeer simply because of who they are and also what they might do. But they haven't actually done anything illegal yet. And this gets into some themes that have been explored in sci-fi, like what if we get to the point where we can read people's minds and they think of doing a crime? Can you then attack, arrest them, you know, prosecute them? But if they haven't actually done anything, like, where do you draw the line? What we have right now, at best, is if we take everything that O said, kind of light most favorable to her, we have a group of synthetics that may one day rise up and create this Holocaust. Does that mean we get to terminate them? Yeah, I think that's a tough case to make, even if we're defending O. I mean, we'd argue that, but it would be tough. What do you think, Christine?
Yeah, this feels a little too preemptive for me, because it's not a foregone conclusion. We don't know that much about Soji and Dodge, of course, because she dies in the first episode, but we don't really know too much about what they're capable of. And it doesn't sound like from the episode that that Janna and Beautiful Flowers characters really got fleshed out either in terms of what, you know, what is their capacity. It was interesting to me that they both went together, whereas Dodge and Soji were deliberately sent on separate missions. Maybe somebody learned from that experience. Don't send your synths together, because that way they can both die together.
Yeah. Well, like their missions were also fundamentally different. Like one was, you know, in those who were executed, it was first contact. It was seeking out brave new worlds. And the second was like, well, they murdered two of us, and we need to figure out why this Borg cube had its submatrix fail. So let's do this on the low key going forward, because some of those folks are, you know, the nice ones murdered our people.
The other interesting thing that you mentioned, Josh, is that it was an unlawful order, which kind of gets to another issue of Vandermeer's possible defense, right? So if something is a lawful order, he might have a legal defense of obedience to order. But if something's an unlawful order, he may or may not have a defense. Just looking at the military judge's bench book discussion here on how to instruct for this defense, it says obedience to an unlawful order does not necessarily result in criminal responsibility of the person obeying the order. The acts of the accused, if done in obedience to an unlawful order, are excused and carry no criminal responsibility unless the accused knew the order was unlawful or unless the order was one which a person of ordinary common sense under the circumstances would know to be unlawful. But it sounds like from Vandermeer's reaction that maybe he feels that it wasn't lawful.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the fact that he put a phaser in his mouth, you know, highlights the fact he knew it was unlawful. And this is where everyone involved in Starfleet would have needed to follow their morals and their training by going, first off, no, I'm not going to murder these two people. And two, you attack my ship. One, we'll be ready for it because we're going to tell everyone what's going on. And secondly, whatever ship shows up with, wait, we're supposed to blow up one of our own ships? No. Like, that too would have been an illegal order on its face of, we don't go out and destroy our own people. What the hell's going on here? Which goes back to the bigger issue of, we're just going to have this big secret to commit genocide because we know it's best. very dangerous. I mean, I understand state secrets, and not everything can be public. There are things that are going to have to be classified. That's just the nature of defending nations, you know, and how that works. Like, that's normal. But when it's something of that magnitude, and say, trust us, we know that we have to eliminate all these forms of life, that's a bit much. You know, that'd be like after 9/11, we went, you know what, we're just going to nuke Afghanistan. We're going to create the island of Israel in the Middle East. No, I'm like, that's not what we did, because that's not who we are. And where Picard is going, as in the series, not the character, is showing basically through O's manipulation how Starfleet's lost its way in value mm-hmm. system with, you know, the perceived threat of AI, instead of realizing, okay, they're out there. We're going to cross that valley at some point. Let's be ready.
Picard's comments in the first episode of the series were very prescient when he said that it was no longer Starfleet. And he's right. You had someone as powerful as O, that high up, you know, influencing Starfleet, pushing us into isolation, not really who we are.
And I think the fact that it is so secret is part of what makes people so uncomfortable with this idea, right? So you have a secret planet and a secret system with a well of knowledge that only a very few people have access to, and that which even the viewer gets to see is pretty fragmented, and that's supposed to be the basis of, you know, these horrific acts, these murders. It's kind of hard to take.
Yeah, it's right to say no.
Josh, I was just going to say your point is well taken, because, you know, we've got this horrendous knowledge. The Romulans get it somehow, and they take it upon themselves to make the decision for the rest of the universe that we're going to be the guardians, or we're going to decide that AI doesn't get to live. But should they get to make that call? And that's what I think what it comes down to. You know, do we trust them to make that call because they know better than the rest of us? You know, or would we trust someone else? Or, you know, should it be open up to the government to debate?
Yeah, that is such a dangerous viewpoint of, don't worry, they know what's best.
Yeah, like, they got this, you know, don't worry.
Yeah, that's
right. There's no democratic debate or discussion here.
Nope.
We're just going to trust this to a secret enclave
right.
of decision makers.
Wink, wink, nod, nod. We got this. We're going to kill whoever we need. All right. Just trust us. There's a good reason.
Yeah, I, again, you know, having, you know, covert operations, I'm fine with that, the entire concept of that, as that's how governments function. But it's not against an entire race. You know, it's one thing to, you know, have the black ops team to go like, okay, we know where the terrorist cells are, and we're going to go out and go after them and, you know, eliminate them. Like, we do that sort of thing. We don't say, well, we're going to take out everyone who follows that faith, all of them. And we're going to do it in secret and not talk about it. And there's no, we're not going to follow any of the rules that we have. We're just going to go out and do it. That's it's not our value system. And in Star Trek, it's supposed to represent the best of our value system. So no, it's very Soviet. It's very, very Soviet. Anyway, I digress there. We get the issue of, related of, a cover up. So what, you know, Rios ends up having to carry out his, you know, captain's responsibility of covering up what happened on board. And that breaks him. I mean, it breaks his faith. But why don't we take a look at what's that cover-up mean? Because that's different. Because it's a fraud. You know, it's a fraud upon, you know, his captain's career. And it's a betrayal of values. Like, what does, you know, that cover-up mean legally and functionally? And Christine, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is it does, So it serves O's interests, right? She has the secret group that she's working with, and it really kind of it raises the question of who is O working for? What organization is she working for in this capacity? And then by extension, she's made Rios her agent. So whose interests is he serving? And he aware of whose interests he's serving? He doesn't seem to be. But it doesn't seem like O is she may be giving the order on the surface in her capacity as a Starfleet officer, but she has an ulterior motive. She's working for this other organization, the secret organization. There's a lot to unpack there.
Steve, can you help the unpacking?
There definitely is a lot to go through here. So if we're looking at what would Rios be facing as the survivor of this horrible incident, you know, he covers it up, sees his captain murder what he thinks are two innocent people. I don't think he realizes that they are synthetics at the time. And, you know, he sees that, well, I mean, we've got a couple of things going on here. Just sort of the human side is the captain, who we are told represents Vandermeer, represents the best and greatest of Starfleet. He seems to know these orders are wrong. He kills them, carries out the orders nonetheless, because his ship is under threat of harm if he does not. So he kills these two people in cold blood with his phaser, and he can't take it because it's torn his soul apart, because he knows he's done the wrong thing, and it tears at him. So he shoots himself. Rios now has to see all this, and he's traumatized, understandably so, because of this captain with whom he had some sort of paternal, like father-son type of relationship, has done these horrible things and then killed himself. Rios then, as you say, participates in the cover-up, thinking it's the least he could do to try to honor the memory of this person who he considered to be a father figure. So let's look at Rios' liability here. If he were to stand trial, one of the first things I think that he would have to face is that, and I don't know that we've seen this in any particular episode, but as any public servant, any government employee, certainly any military soldier has to do typically when they enter the service, is they have to swear an oath. And that oath is to the country, your service, that you have undivided loyalty, and you know you will uphold the laws, the ideals, things like that. And the oath, certainly on the federal side that is sworn, each federal employee, civil servant that swears the oath, they swear the same oath that people swear all the way up the chain of command up to the president. So it's the same oath. Rios presumably has sworn some form of oath when he joined Starfleet. Again, we may not know precisely what that is, but I think it's a pretty fair bet that participating in this cover-up and by extension kind of making himself a part of the treasonous acts that Vandermeer, undertook, Rios has probably violated that oath. He's in a lot of trouble if that ever were to come out, and it looks like it never did because O and Starfleet Security were able to kind of sweep it all under the rug. But Rios, like his mentor before him, Vandermeer, is also torn apart by this, and he just can't deal with it. He knows he's done horrible things, and he ends up washing out of Starfleet. So, you know, the question is, if we're defending Rios, I mean, he's in some trouble. It would be very difficult. It'd be an interesting question, because if we're defending Rios at some sort of court martial, how do you defend him without going into some of these illegal orders that he got? And then you would have to expose all of that. I mean, this could become its own movie. You know, you try to expose sort of the Conclave of Eight, then Rios himself would probably be in jeopardy. And then what happens after that? You know, Commodore O wouldn't let that come to light. And then does she kill Rios? And, you know, what would the next step be? It would be difficult to defend this because you got secrets upon secrets here.
Yes, there is. It requires people to say no. I mean, like, that's the big thing. Of when you are asked to do something that's legally and morally wrong, yes, say no. And, you know, this goes back to all the wonderful psychology experiments and sociology experiments, like, you know, Philip Zimbardo, and whether it's the Stanford Prison Experiment, or, you know, the one that was done in, Munich in the 1960s, where, hey, if they get the wrong answer, you give them a shock.
Right.
It was like 90% of the people who did that would have given a fatal shock. Now,
yeah,
it was an actor on the other side who was screaming in agony, but it just highlighted people were willing to, like, well, the guy in the lab coat said, you know, shock him. So I did. And it's again, if somebody says, do something wrong, you say no.
I think that just underscores how hard it is to say no, though. And so it's, you know, to be fair to Rios, it's easy for us to sort of sit here after the fact and say, oh, well, had I been there, I certainly would have said no. I mean, you know, it's really hard to judge that. You know, poor Vandermeer is told, you have to kill these people or we will destroy your ship. I mean, how long? He doesn't really have a lot of time to decide. And now he's thinking, my God, this is coming from Starfleet Security. You know, this organization to whom I've sworn my loyalty, and this is what they are now. You know, it's hard to judge him fairly. You know, he's really put in an impossible situation.
Yeah,
and his level of knowledge is not, he's even further removed than Vandermeer's. I mean, he has maybe a similar ability to judge the lawfulness of the order, but he has a worse ability to know the fact that the order is maybe not even really coming from Starfleet. It's coming from this other organization that is not functioning within the bounds of the Federation.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah. It makes sense why he's had problems and he left. It's just, he had a rough day. And why, you know, he maintains his ship like he's still in Starfleet, because on one level, he, you know, his heart still is.
You know, it's interesting to just observe when we have the people all sitting around the table towards the latter half of the episode, kind of like a ready room scene, you know, where they're sort of briefing and putting the puzzle pieces together. Each of them has a piece of the puzzle. But what we really have, I think we have five people, you know, Picard, Girardi, Raffi, Rios, and then Soji, five people who are all sort of disillusioned and have been harmed because Starfleet is no longer what they thought it was. And they're all facing, well, okay, what happened? Where do we go wrong? And we've all been driven out by the thing that we used to love. You know, it's interesting, but maybe that begins the path to healing or rebuilding the Federation.
Well, and the other thing is, when they're in isolation, they're having problems with it. When they're working together, they can figure out a way to solve the problem. And, you know, that we saw that on one level depicted with Soji and with, like, I'm just going to jump start the ship and, you know, go. Let's go. And it's like, and everyone's like, pump the brakes. Easy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this. And like, let's come up with a plan together on what we're going to do. And let's approach it that way, which again, working together, people are on one level easier to do the right thing because everyone going like, hey, this is the right thing to do. Let's go for it. Cause we've talked about it and we have a course of action. Yeah. Let's talk about some of the things that happen on the Borg cube. So we have Annika, you know, show up guns blazing and, you know, be full on action hero. And, you know, she took out a bunch of Romulans. I'll just say, look justified. defense of others. Yep. She did what she had to do and, lit the whoop ass lamp. And that was cool. But we have mass shootings of XBs and just XBs getting killed left and right. And is that because of who they were? You know, which again, we've dealt with mass shootings way too often in the last 6 months of people being shot at because of the color of their skin. And I mean, I think this is highly analogous to, you know, what Star Trek Picard was showing. I mean, do either of you have a reaction to that?
Sure, Josh. well, I think, I mean, so again, this is interesting because you've got Narissa there with her security forces, and she's attacking both the reclaimed Borg, and also trying to figure out a way to get rid of the Borg in stasis, because there's some threat once Annika arrives that this cube may be reactivated. So you can definitely look at it through the lens of is Narissa able to do this as a government actor? And it's interesting because it's a little bit unclear whether she's acting within her capacity with the Federation, or whether she's acting in some other capacity. So, for example, as a citizen of the Romulan Free State, or as a member of the secretive organization. So yeah, I mean, I think you could try to view it through the lens of civil rights law. Is this excessive force resulting in death, or is it just murder?
You know, these are heavy topics, Josh, as you point out. I mean, we're talking about mass killings here, and it's not really clear exactly why she's necessarily doing this, except that she's trying to hunt down Hugh, who, you know, well, she kills him. And then, you know, sort of our last member of our crew there, who is hard pressed when Seven comes in to save him. But then she just starts, they don't really appear to be much of a threat to her. And then she starts executing Borg. Seven starts, you know, getting the Borg cube to heal. And Narissa seems to just say, okay, well, it's time for us to get out of here. And I'm just going to kill everyone that's here. She starts by killing the reclaimed Borg, and that's just really tragic, because I think it was only two episodes ago that Picard said they are victims as much as anyone else, and they are. You know, we see some familiar faces who had looks of relief and joy upon realizing that they were starting to regain their humanity or whatever race they were, and now their lives are all cut short. And then she takes it a step further, and you know, there are a number of Borg drones still in stasis, and she starts just jettisoning them en masse, you know, into space to kill all of them too. I mean, it looks like a genocide in many ways. So that's, I mean, we're really hitting on war crimes here, I think.
Right, and it doesn't seem like there's, I mean, in terms of their survival, it doesn't seem like there's much of a practical difference between being one of the reclaimed, somebody who's received some kind of treatment, versus somebody who's still being held in stasis and maybe waiting for that opportunity. She's killing everybody with, you know, the same stroke.
Yeah, it's super evil. It's just, I mean, she's gone beyond the Wicked Witch. I mean, this is like way beyond flying monkeys at this point in time. She's, you know, kind of genocidal maniac. And it was nice seeing her get mobbed by all those XBs just beating the snot out of her. So,
but then she beams out.
But then she escapes.
Yeah, they always escape.
Well, yeah, I mean, they got in a few good licks. So it's don't worry, I'm sure Space Grandpa will take care of her later. So it's all gonna work
you know,
out.
question here, because I thought that she had managed to eject most of the Borg drones that were in stasis, or who were in stasis. So who is it that attacks her? I was wondering for a moment, are these newly assimilated Romulans who are now attacking her? I couldn't really tell. It's just happened so quickly.
They looked very XB to me. And so,
okay. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, they looked very XB of, she didn't get them all. And they were very unhappy with her. So
I love Seven's reaction. You know, she's hesitant to kind of create the micro collective and become a queen. And then suddenly, wait, what are these lights are going out? Are they dying? And then she just gets that look of fierce determination, like, you do not harm my fellow drones. And then she becomes the queen again, or rather not again, but she assumes that mantle. And wow, I mean, just the character moment, the character arc for Seven, who has spent so much time trying to regain her humanity, to go away from the Borg collective, and now she becomes the queen. Like, wow, you know, faces her greatest fear.
Well, that, and also refers to herself as Annika. So
yes, Annika has work to do. That was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
let's, so she's got her agency still, even though she's I mean, which makes sense. She's in control of a collective on a smaller scale.
Yeah. And she had moral problems of using others, you know, invading their consciousness and, you know, using them. And like, again, she found that offensive, but necessity dictated of we're all going to die unless I do something. So then all those people ended up dying anyway. So
yeah, that was actually the most interesting part of that episode for me, Josh. I don't know if other people had thoughts on this too, but does anybody feel like there's maybe some potential for criticism of Seven for taking this on, even though she knows that she's taking away these people's autonomy again, and there's definitely a downside to what she's doing.
It's you know, she's not happy. You know, and again, I ironically do think of Star Trek the Motion Picture because of you know, Decker merges with V'ger, and on one level that's what Seven's doing with the micro collective and trying to stop a greater harm, which is different because like her plan wasn't to use the Borg on that ship as cannon fodder. Her intent was to save lives, which is different, and to stop those who were murdering XBs. Then there would be larger problems of once, you know, trying to reintegrate them and reclaim them. But, you know, very different situation of trying to justify mass murder.
Right. I mean, she's effectively subjecting them to involuntary servitude again. Although I think there's a lot of problems with viewing this particular issue through the lens of U.S. civil rights law. There's just a lot of things that don't really quite fit. But it's interesting. I started to look, and I did actually find a case where, at least in theory, it recognized the possibility that you could impose civil liability under our federal civil rights statute and the 13th Amendment in the context of an inmate confined in a mental hospital for subjecting somebody to involuntary servitude. The case didn't get very far because the court was just analyzing it at a very early stage. But it's kind of interesting to think about from that angle. I think it probably doesn't ultimately work because Seven she's not really much of a state actor at that point. It's hard to say she's acting under color of any state's law that you could assign as being part of the Federation. But it's an interesting lens to view that through.
It's definitely, it falls under necessity of I don't want to do this. Also, what could she communicate to the collective of, you know, the Romulans are a threat to you actively. They want to harm others. And, you know, we need to stop that harm from happening. And that's different than just using them. It's guiding them by principle, and that we don't get to see if that's what happened, because but we also know Borg can survive in space. So the issue is if they're, you know, like floating free in multiple directions, how do you, you know, could she tractor beam them all back type of thing?
That's a good point. Yeah. We see in First Contact that drones can survive in space. So, you know,
Yeah, they're not dead. They might be inaccessible. They all have that personal shield. So good for them.
That's where I put necessity as well. I mean, if you're faced with a rogue government agent who wants to murder former Borg, is there any way to stop that short of reassimilating into a micro collective? Right. Possibly not.
Yeah, really, really hard.
And one interesting question that comes up too is, and Josh, you and I discussed this on another episode. I don't remember which one, but who at this point, what is the legal status of these Borg drones? And are they their own race, their own culture? Are they still members of the race that they were formerly a part of before they became assimilated? If they are killed now, what country would claim them and try to come, you know, and would a country step forward to claim them and try to exact revenge? You know, there's just a lot of legal gray area here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a undiscovered country. So let's get into, Christine, did you want to add something?
The only other thing I would add to that is it's kind of interesting that Annika says that she can steal the cube.
Oh, right.
It was a collective, but the concept of personal property still applies.
Property rights, yeah.
Or a property, viewing it through the lens of a property crime, is this joyriding? Is this cube jacking?
Is it, yeah, because it's not being used? I mean, it's just sitting there.
Is it abandoned? Yeah.
Yeah, good point.
What does she do with it now? Because, you know, Christine, you mentioned state actor. She's not really part of a state. She's part of the Fenris Rangers, right? Like this sort of vigilante group. So does she claim this as their new headquarters now? I mean, who knows, you know?
Look what I got, guys.
Right. Is this legitimate salvage?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Who better to salvage it than a former drone like herself? But,
yeah, there's a lot to unpack. Or here's an idea. Let's get out of Romulan space. Like, let's go someplace, you know, Federation, or, you know, Klingons might be less of a hassle to deal with.
Like, go somewhere a little less hostile.
yeah. There's Andorians. They're nice. Let's go hang out with them. Those blue guys were friendly. Lot there. Or Vulcans, they'd be dedicated to the greater good. Let's go hang out with them. Which then brings us to kind of some of the other issues of, you know, Picard does make a report to Admiral Clancy, our swearing admiral, and it was fun to see him. What did you call me, senile?
Quixotic, senile, yeah.
Yeah, and just seeing her, like, just kind of, like, squirm and just stare him down and telling him to shut up.
Yeah, you want an apology?
No, yeah. I want a squadron.
Yes.
I want to believe the Enterprise E under Captain Worf is in that squadron, but that's, because that would just wishful fan theory here. A lot of people from the Next Generation should be captains or admirals in their own right by now. And that would be a nice little fan service way of, you know, when we see the squadron, that it's Worf with Enterprise E, it's LaForge on, what was it, Yosemite or whatever he commanded in Voyager. And you could just work in a couple others as well of, you know, you don't need everyone, but just two or three that are now captains would be a nice tip of the hat to fans and, you know, writing in to go save, you know, their old shipmate. But that's just me and wishful thinking and a nice way to show Michael Dorn and LeVar Burton and all those folks.
Well, actually one connection, Josh, just on that point. I think many people caught this, but not everyone. At the very end of this episode, I'm jumping ahead maybe slightly, but when Rios is talking to Admiral Picard, and Picard says, well, you know, Vandermeer was first officer to a former Academy classmate of mine. And then Rios says, yes, Captain Marta, and I'm going to butcher it, Batanavides. So she's a character, for those who may not remember, from the episode Tapestry, Next Generation, where Picard, through Q's power, goes back and kind of relives his Academy days. Marta is just a terrific character, one of his best friends. They've been up to a lot of trouble together, and she and Picard always had this sort of could have been between them, like a romance, and they never follow through on it, but then they do when, you know, when Q gives Picard this other chance. Anyways, like, we never really see her again outside of that one episode until this reference, and we find out she made captain. Beyond that, we don't know much more, but I just think it's fantastic that that character is referenced here. We know that she went on to do well. They presumably kept in touch, at least to some degree. She could be someone that shows up in the next, you know, when the fleet arrives, the squadron arrives.
Yeah, she could be the admiral commanding it. So again, there's all kinds of fun fan service that they can do with this. And that's tasteful, you know, because like I didn't look up the captain's name, but I thought like, hey, I bet that was, you know, the female classmate from Tapestry.
Yep.
Who Picard ended up having a fling with. You know,
I cheered when I saw her because I had the subtitles. I was like, oh my God, yeah, that was great. I thought.
Yeah, tasteful fan service. It's like, yes. if you don't know, it's not like they're winking at the camera. It's just nice. Good work, guys. But again, Deep Space, was it Deep Space 12? I'm pretty sure it was definitely 12. So
yeah.
Let's get into, do we have a little bit more on how to defend Dr. Agnes Girardi? Because there's the discussion that she has a like a psychic block from being able to completely understand or access what O did to her. And I do wonder if there's more to what happened from O that could allow us a form of the insanity defense. And Christine, you and I have on, you know, panels with other properties discussed the insanity defense. Do you have a take on that, on whether there's a way to defend the good doctor?
On Agnes, yeah, this is an intense scene with her. I think it's a really good scene where she says she has this block, and then Picard, you know, kind of tries to start to say something. She's like, I don't want to talk about it. It's so intense. I think the jury is out on this. I'm not willing to give up on this defense for Agnes, either. I mean, there's the mind meld, obviously. But then the addition of the psychic block is some next level manipulation that O is able to pull off. Does it take her to the point where she's not aware of her actions, or she doesn't know that they're wrong? It's still kind of a tough one. She has enough awareness that the emergency medical hologram gets triggered twice, right? At least twice, comes to ask her about the nature of her psychiatric emergency. And so she's got some awareness going on there, even if it's subconscious.
Agreed. Yeah, there's, again, this is where a psychologist would be helpful in understanding, did she have agency with this? Because it looks like she did. But the underlying issue was there an irresistible impulse put in by O, or some other manipulation that O did to make Agnes act outside of her agency, so she fully didn't, while she understood the wrongfulness of her actions, it's not clear if she could control that or stop it. And it's kind of a tough call. We don't have expert witnesses on Vulcan mind melds.
I mean, yet.
Like, yeah, sure. There is nerd rage out there. In this episode, sure, we get that. But what we don't have is an actual psychologist with written scholarly works on the
peer-reviewed.
peer-reviewed with the medical effects of, like how McCoy was messed up from having Spock's Katra in him, and how that made McCoy act oddly in Star Trek III. So
I wonder if there's another way to conceptualize the defense besides just mental incapacity or insanity. I mean, I wonder if some variety on unconsciousness might be a better fit. With specifically with the Vulcan mind meld. I mean, you've got all this other stuff going on too, because on top of that, she's got the Viridium tracker, and who knows what that is doing. But maybe there's another defense that would be better suited for her.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll have a better idea as the series goes. And Steve, you're good with the deep Trek references. Wasn't Viridium what Spock put on Kirk's jacket in Star Trek VI so they could track
it? Apparently it was, yeah. And this must be extremely powerful as a tracker because they're able to track across several sectors. You know, in Star Trek VI, Kirk and McCoy are taken to Ruapenthe, the penal colony deep within Klingon territory, and yet the Enterprise, remaining in Federation space, is able to track them from who knows how far away. Yeah. So the distance, the range on this is just astounding. You know, I would say on Girardi, there's a couple other interesting things to ponder. You know, Christine raises an interesting point. Is there another angle we could approach? And I think, I don't know how far we can push this, but if you can go more in the direction of, hey, O made her do it. You know, O made her do it, would be sort of the defense. So Agnes didn't have her faculties, or she was terrified. She had these things implanted in her mind, these blocks or whatnot. More and more, you try to push the responsibility off on the perpetrator, O, you know, of the mental, you know, the mental devices, and less on Girardi. We get back to sort of the Manchurian candidate idea, you know, that Josh, you and I have talked about. I don't know if that would work or not, but another point to consider is that let's say somehow we defend Agnes or she gets just some fantastic criminal defense attorney and she actually gets off, she walks and found not guilty by whatever reason. Well, that could also be seen as creating a dangerous precedent because let's say O and the rest of the Conclave of Eight, you know, they all get prosecuted. They could all point to, hey, look, the person who we know killed someone got off. You know, how can you convict her and how can you not convict her and yet try to convict us? It could set a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, I agree. It seems like in recent episodes, you see people maybe not reacting as strongly to murderers on board as you might expect. You yeah. kind of thought that a little bit of Valk and Slash. Yeah, in Discovery. Yeah. Right. It's like, oh, well, but he was clearly someone else when this occurred. Wait a minute. There's a dead person here.
That's the plan? Yeah. Like that's. we're okay with this? All right. Let's, okay, giddy up.
Yeah. Life is not viewed in the same way anymore, apparently.
Yeah, it's like, it's like, are we sure we want to go there? Are we sure that's a good idea? Again, very mixed feelings. Very, very mixed feelings on that. Now let's go back to the other part of this of, oh, and like we've talked about this to a degree, but if she's half Vulcan, and I mean theoretically she depends where she grew up, but if she grew up in the Federation with Romulan loyalty and joined Starfleet with the intent of being a double agent, that's treason. there's no good spin on that. That's treason, and that'd be bad. That'd be very bad. So, but yeah, the attack on Mars, it's tough to walk that off. do either of you have thoughts on O and what she represents?
Well, it might make sense to treat her acts under the overarching, umbrella of disloyalty, right? What are the crimes that relate to that, treason or espionage or something along those lines that she's serving two, more than one governmental master?
Yeah, well, and I don't know if the Jad Vashem is a government agency, if not a cult.
Yeah, it's a little unclear exactly what it is. It's an organization of some kind. It's yeah, I don't know that it rises to the level of a government entity in and of itself. It's
that they're a shadow organization, really. And
yeah.
it seems like I highly doubt that she answers to the Romulan praetor. You know, like the mm-hmm. if the praetor said, "Oh, well, I want you, to do this," I don't think she would have to follow. She would just say, "No, we're the Jad Vashem. We don't care what you say." You know, that's my impression, at least. I don't know.
Yeah, not good.
She is a fascinating. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Josh.
I was about to say a JAG officer should be able to convict her with a fair amount of ease. The issue is what charges are brought and what's left off the table, because the slaughter on Mars is ripe for prosecution.
It cries out, and they've never solved that mystery or charged anyone for it, apparently. I do want to say O is, I think, a great character, probably the greatest villain that we have in this season, because you can understand why she's doing what she does, even if you disagree with it. You know, she certainly feels that it's a righteous cause. She's embedded so deeply in the fabric of Starfleet that it's going to be hard to really pull her out and expose her. You know, even this call that was made for a squadron of starships to rendezvous at Deep Space 12, what if that goes through O, and O somehow puts people in charge who, you know, maybe have to answer to her? Are we sort of, you know, in trouble to another level now?
Yeah, good question. I don't think Clancy was informed about O's duplicity. Like that wasn't clear because we don't see the entire conversation between her and Picard. And there was stuff that I don't think Picard knew yet from Agnes about O's involvement. So he should have sent an update of like, hey, guess what? Don't trust O. And like arrest her right now and throw her sunglass wearing badass in prison or brig. And get the JAG office on the phone right now.
And we really have, I can only think of one other parallel for O that is a half Vulcan, half Romulan, that being Savick, Lieutenant Savick, who was introduced in Star Trek II. Now, at first, we're not told that she's half Romulan, but they developed that a little bit later in the novelizations, and I think they mentioned it on screen at some point as well. But she's shown to us as someone who has less control of her emotions, over her emotions, than a Mr. Spock. She has a lot more fire and passion. And that takes several forms in the novelizations as well, where she supposedly has a romantic relationship with David, you know, the son of Kirk. But that's never explored on screen. That's only, you know, sort of in the novelizations. But there are some good books that talk about Savick and her struggle to find an identity caught between two worlds, Vulcan and Romulus. And what that does to her and how she has to try to reconcile that. And, you know, maybe O has, you know, had that as well. Maybe she's been born with sort of these dual allegiances and has struggled to balance them.
Agreed. Yeah, there's, again, a lot there. And we'll see where they go with it. We will see where they go with it. So with that, I think we've covered everything that jumps out from Broken Pieces. I think we have put them together.
May I ask a question here, just out of curiosity, as we enter the last two episodes, which may be a two-part season finale, any predictions from you guys?
That they don't fumble the ball like Discovery did. And
I think that's more of a hope, right? But
yeah, it's... We don't need lots of speeches. People shouldn't say goodbye like six times. It's just, you know, and if you have technology that can take you anywhere in the universe, the problem solved in like 3 minutes as opposed to two episodes. That aside, let's find out what the connection to Data is. Let's find out, did Maddox find this planet of advanced AI or did they find him? What's the connection there? Have they interacted with humanity before. You know, again, you know, we've never seen the closure of Captain Decker. That could be, because again, we've dealt with AI before, and except this AI can hope and dream and, you know, have, you know, the human adventure, like what's beyond logic. How old is this race? Because again, if they're a century old because of other events, what's that? You know, what will we see? But we know that, you know, they're shooting the second season, or they've either completed it. We know Whoopi Goldberg was coming back as Gaiden, you know, to the joy of nerds everywhere.
And Robert Beltran as the EMA for some role. Also.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah.
He announced that he had been approached, at least.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. So, cool.
Yeah, right. Christine, any predictions?
So I don't have predictions, but I definitely have things that I hope that they follow up on, because I thought they were interesting, and the series hasn't really answered it. I was really kind of fascinated with that whole exchange between Soji and Rhonda when she talks to her in episode 3.
Yeah.
While Rhonda's kind of manipulating the Pikmin. And then later you see those same cards in later scenes. And then I think also in the scene where, or in the episode where they pick up Elnor. And Soji comments to her in this conversation that they have that she's really interested in understanding how former Borg might have a shared narrative framework to understand their trauma that's as relevant as the day's news, which just makes me so curious about what Soji is doing there, because it seems like that statement must give some insight into her mission and why she is on the cube in the first place. You know, she's trying to understand what caused the submatrix collapse and what went wrong in trying to assimilate the Romulans. And is she trying to do that so that she could fix it? And in what way is she trying to fix it? And where is this coming from? I hope they tie all those things up.
It could also be a great way to liberate people from the Borg. It's
right.
Because the Borg is,
which hasn't happened. They're not released. They're reclaimed.
Yeah. Yes.
But if there's, you know, this weapon, because they figured out, okay, we send Q back with his Hugh back with his individuality, you know, and that causes a cube to collapse and people to, you know, start waking up. We know from Voyager with Submatrix Zero that their subconsciouses like can dream, and you know, there are ways to connect with Borg who are, you know, still in the collective and help liberate them. Mm-hmm. And that there was the Borg insurrection that we also saw in Voyager. All of that, you know, as background, if they're able to weaponize whatever was in, you know, that happened when Rhonda was assimilated, is that a way to like start knocking Borg cubes out of service and start reclaiming people? And mm-hmm. was it Rhonda's like vision that she saw from Ea or the Grief Planet that caused the Submatrix to collapse? Because did the collective see that and just freak out?
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And break down of, whoa, what's that? And did that cause the Submatrix to collapse? Because that could be weaponized in some way.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you can reclaim people from the Borg.
Yeah. Any other hopes or predictions there, Christine or Josh?
You know, I'd be fine with Patrick Stewart just talking about wine pairings each episode. I'm grateful to have good Star Trek back. And I'm very happy with, you know, having this golden age where we could talk about Star Trek again and have it be meaningful.
So, Christine, any other thoughts there?
Same. Same, and more Next Generation characters returning. That's my wish.
Yeah. They all don't have to be at once. Like, the way we saw Reichert and Troy was meaningful. But yeah, I do hope we see in the finale a nice little curtain call of some of the other characters, and because that would be fun, because a bunch should be captains or admirals.
So I'll answer my own question, I guess. There are a couple things I'd love to see. One would be some of the characters back, but also so that we could see them still in Starfleet, because we still haven't really, we've seen all this from the perspective of outsiders to Starfleet now. And that's been odd, not bad, but it's definitely been different. I predict that, this is sort of minor, I guess, but I think Soji will be put in a position where she could probably kill Narek. And she'll, take revenge. But I predict that she'll probably forego that and kind of show her humanity. There could be a couple of amazing twists. Like, what if they get to this planet, and as Christine was talking about, as we're getting to this planet, well, we don't know what's on this planet. Were they there before for a long time, or did Bruce Maddox create them? What if we get there and we find Bruce Maddox? And the one that was killed was perhaps a clone, a copy, a synth or something like that. Or if we get there and we find Data, and he's been reconstituted from the single neuron, and he says, I was hoping you would come find me. There could be all sorts of, fascinating directions in which this could go. So I'm very excited by it. I share all the passion and enthusiasm you guys have for having Star Trek back. It's been really a terrific ride.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before, but the fact Picard was dreaming about Data in order to kick this off, and we haven't seen that happen since.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised for a Q appearance.
That would be fantastic.
Because I don't think the Queen cards were a reference to...
Right, the Queens.
The Queens. I think they were a reference to Q.
Right. And what about when when Picard is asking Soji about emotions and things, and then she turns it around on him and asks, how would you like to have been remembered by Data? And Picard has to say, I hope he would think of me as someone who was supportive and there for him and all this. And then Soji just simply says, he did love you. And you're thinking, wait a second. That sounds a little more first person than sort of outside observer. Is there something coming down the pipe?
Well, if she does have a single neuron of Data somehow, then she would know. She might not have remembering everything Data did, but just not like, no, he loved you. You were like a dad to him. It would be something like that. And because that's stuff that goes beyond words and experiences to, something else. So again, that human quality.
And if there's that spark of Data left, maybe they can, on this planet, they can build him a new body and we get Data back.
I'm okay with not getting Data back because, death is permanent. And one way that, there are other forms of immortality, whether it's, your kin going on or the thing that you built continuing, whether that's a country or an institution. So his sacrifice had to have meaning. It can't be, like meaningless of like death doesn't matter. We're able to get people back all the time. It's like, So anywho, Christine, closing thoughts?
Closing thoughts. This isn't a legal question. If you had to pick a band to create an original piece entitled The Call of the Destroyer, which band would you choose to write that song?
That Ooh. Is not what I was expecting, but okay.
Throwing you a curveball.
Either
you don't have to answer now. You can think about it.
Well, I'll go with it. Either you go with AC/DC, you go with Megadeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good choices.
Megadeth had lots of stuff like that, from whether it's Tail Gunner or any of their other classics. But it could also be like another curveball, say somebody like a Peter Gabriel, and with something.
Right.
Very like solace and sincere and sorrowful. So again, there are a couple ways that you could go with that. Just showing my musical taste.
That's wow. Awesome. I went a little metal with that too at first. I thought I thought either somebody like Amon Amarth or In Flames, some nice melodic death metal, would just do a killer job with that song.
Yeah.
I think Metallica would be a good choice too. You know, they delve into a lot of that stuff. Enter Sandman and One. I don't know, some dark stuff there. I like the sorrowful but kind of hopeful idea. Peter Gabriel, yeah. You know, that could be interesting.
Yeah, it's sometimes, you know, you just yes. I do enjoy Peter Gabriel. Anywho, well, with that, this has been lots of fun. For those who've stuck it out to the end, thank you for listening. We do have our Patreon, which has some extra content on it, so check that out. We are on many different podcast platforms, so whatever one that you listen on, please leave a review. We really appreciate that. And everyone, stay geeky, America.